Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Friday, November 10th, 2023. The body monitoring South Sudan's 2018 peace agreement says the signatories of the deal have done very little in implementing key provisions.
Adequately resource the Reconstituent Political Parties Council, the Reconstituted National Constitutional Review Commission, and the Reconstituted National Elections Commission to effectively discharge their mandates, finalize the passage of the National Security Service Act, complete the unification and the deployment of forces.
And the South Sudan government pays $7 million US dollars to the East African community.
This money is to cover both our arrears and the current financial year 2024, respectively. We are putting $3 million dollars to the arrears of 2022-2023 financial year.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. UN's acting humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan has condemned the killing of a humanitarian worker in South Sudan's Greater Pibor administrative area. The local humanitarian aid worker was killed while responding to a suspected measles outbreak. For VOA News, Charlton Doki has more from Juba.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA, says a South Sudanese aid worker was killed while on a field trip to an area where a measles outbreak was reported. UN OCHA says the aid worker was contracted by an international NGO but did not name the NGO. In a statement issued Friday, the acting humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, Marie Helen Vanier, said, quote, "I convey my deepest condolences to the family and loved ones of this colleague, a nutrition officer who was going the extra mile so that the children of Boma, Greater Pibor administrative area, live to see the age of five and who was killed in the line of duty," end quote. Vani says she is appalled by the continued targeting of humanitarians and their assets. She further says, quote, "Access constraints, bureaucratic impediments, the impact of ongoing violence and widespread criminality hamper the work of aid actors across the country. For several years running, South Sudan has remained the most dangerous place for aid workers. This cannot continue," end quote. The acting humanitarian coordinator says violent acts against aid workers obstruct the delivery of life-saving support to vulnerable citizens, including women, children, the elderly, and disabled people. She called on the South Sudanese authorities to protect both civilians and aid workers. Vani also told armed groups and individuals to stop harassing humanitarian workers or else they would leave. She adds that, quote, "All forms of violence against civilians and humanitarians are unacceptable," end quote. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
From Juba, we move to the United States here, going to New York. A South Sudanese analyst says the move by the Biden administration to cut funds to South Sudan could harm the ordinary vulnerable citizens who depend on services from humanitarian agencies. Jock Madud Jock says South Sudanese leaders should cooperate with the international community to avoid a backlash on the innocent South Sudanese. Jock adds that the transitional government of national unity should demonstrate commitment and transparency to win the support of traditional South Sudanese friends. We now go live to Jock Madud Jock in Syracuse. Jock, good morning.
Good morning to you, sir.
Let me just pick your brain here on this latest development on the decision by the Biden administration to cut funds to aid agencies in South Sudan. I mean, you have written extensively about the country, you know the issues. What are the implications of this decision?
Well, first of all, the decision is unsurprising on account that the world is now facing numerous humanitarian crises, Ukraine and Gaza and Israeli-Gaza war, and many others, such that the pot of money that is available in the United States to give to all these crises is dwindling, and therefore the decision to reduce or cut humanitarian aid to South Sudan is in view of such a background. It's also not surprising because the people of South Sudan, their government, is not a poor government. It's an oil-producing government, as oil-producing country, and therefore the government should have available resources to take care of the welfare of its own citizens. Humanitarian-wise or in terms of education, vaccination, in terms of healthcare in general, South Sudan has been receiving a lot of money from oil sales amounting to no less than $130 million a month since 2006. It would be unimaginable for a country of that wealth to have to outsource the welfare of its people to the international community. So when the U.S. says, now we have other challenges, it is time for you people of South Sudan to take care of yourselves. It is time for the government of that country to lead the way in a fundamental way in taking care of the people and not simply just say we don't have money. It doesn't make sense to the whole community, to the world community, that South Sudan is not endowed with resources enough to give welfare to its people.
Yes. Jock Madud Jock, the repercussions or the ripple effects of this decision is going to be on who? The government or the ordinary people?
It's going to be primarily on the people, obviously, because these are people who have depended on international largesse for going to 40 years. So cutting aid, particularly humanitarian aid, today is going to have serious repercussions on the people who have always relied on this aid for their everyday survival, whether it is in food or in education or in healthcare or even other things like security, like defending the lives of everyday people, defending the lives of children and women against rampant insecurity, rape, abduction, and all that. Over the years, it has been the humanitarian inputs that have tried to address these issues. So with this humanitarian aid, is particularly from the United States being reduced or cut, these are the people who are going to suffer the most. But even the government also suffers because the government has always acted as if it is helpless and doesn't have the resources to take care of its people. Now, with the humanitarian aid gone, they will be called upon and they will be pushed against the wall so hard and be demanded to take responsibility for the welfare of their people like it has never been done before.
Yes,
will they come through? Will they come around and take care of their people now that the international community is withdrawing or reducing its efforts? Or will they simply let their people die, even though they have a lot of money?
Yes, that's easily said than done. But the last question I will throw to you here is what should have been done to avoid this scenario? Just 30 seconds. Time is against us here.
Number one is, of course, to implement the peace agreement and transition the country away from rampant insecurity, disarm the civilians, implement the peace agreement, and show that the government of South Sudan is now providing security for all the different people. And until the security is stabilized, until peace is implemented, the white elephant in the room is always going to be the issue of conflict and violence. And if that conflict and violence continues, South Sudanese themselves will not be able to take care of themselves by means of trade or agricultural production or sale of cattle and what have you. These are not happening because of insecurity. So the responsibility of the government of South Sudan is to provide security and stabilize the country so that ordinary citizens can go about doing their everyday business and take care of themselves.
Well said, Jock Madud Jock. Thank you very much for coming live on this show. That was Jock Madud Jock, former co-founder of the Juba-based SAD Institute and a professor at Syracuse University. He was speaking to me from New York. The body monitoring South Sudan's peace agreement and the United Nations mission in South Sudan are calling on the transitional government of national unity to avail resources for the recently constituted commissions and the unified forces. The head of the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMAC, says the unified forces have been left to languish in training and cantonment sites without support. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
General Charles Tai Gitwai, the head of RJMA, calls on the transitional government of national unity to avail funding for institutions tasked with the implementation of the peace agreement.
Adequately resource the Reconstituent Political Parties Council, the Reconstituent National Constitutional Review Commission, and the Reconstituent National Elections Commission to effectively discharge their mandates. Finalize the passage of the National Security Service Act, complete the unification and the deployment of forces.
Gitwai says for the last 4 years, soldiers have suffered at training and containment centers without any support. He says unification of forces is important for stability and peace in South Sudan. James Nguyen, an official with the National Transitional Committee, a body charged with funding the implementation of the 2018 peace agreement, says the signatories of the peace deal have made progress.
On the 10th of October 2023, the Minister of Defense and the NTC has jointly coordinated and facilitated the transportation of military uniform donated by Republic of Turkey from Mombasa to southern Sudan. And this military uniform was received by the JTV on the 24th of October 2023 through the support of the NTC chair. The NTC has coordinated and facilitated the transportation of forces from Turit, Fanyer, and Turit to Luri training centers for the deployment.
Agag Makur, South Sudan's deputy finance minister, says the government is ready to avail funds to key institutions of the peace agreement.
This government is a government for peace, and even the budget of peace is a priority for the Minister of Finance. It's no problem for payment of NTC. But sometimes because of lack of money or this cost to not get the same amount in the same time. But the Minister of Finance is ready to pay any claim concerning peace.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, and the United Nations Mission in South Sudan and the African Union Mission in South Sudan issued a joint statement saying time is running out for South Sudan signatories of the 2018 peace agreement to iron out the outstanding issues before general elections in 2024. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
Still in Juba, the government of South Sudan says it has paid $7 million to the East African Community as part of its arrears and annual contributions. The undersecretary in the Ministry of East African Affairs says South Sudan remains committed to its obligations under the East African Community Charter. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Ben Gideon, the Undersecretary in the Ministry of East African Community Affairs, says South Sudan remitted $7 million to the account of the East African Community Secretariat to clear some of its financial obligations with the regional bloc.
This money is to cover both our arrears and the current financial year 2024, respectively. We are putting $3 million to the arrears of 2022-2023 financial year, and we have deposited $4 million US dollars as the initial payment of the 2023-2024 financial year.
South Sudan still owes the East African community millions of dollars in arrears and contributions for this financial year. Gideon says the government is aware and is making plans to clear all its debts.
The remaining non-debtors remain to be paid by the government of South Sudan is just exactly $8 million US dollars. And the government has its own plan to finalize the transfer of the remaining $8 million. This is a technical process that I do not want to dwell into it right now. But the Minister of Finance and Planning on behalf of the government, together with the Minister of East African Community, have already put down the plan of transferring this fund to the community by instrument. In other words, what I can say is that we will clear this money before the end of the year.
Gideon says the government's move to pay up its arrears shows that the Kiir administration is committed to meeting its financial obligations in the multilateral institutions, including in the regional East African community. This week, some lawmakers in the East African Legislative Assembly, or EALA, called for the expulsion of member states that fail to meet their financial obligations to the regional bloc. The lawmakers noted that Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda have paid their annual contributions to the community. For several years, South Sudan and Burundi have defaulted on their financial obligations to the regional body. But Gideon says the government of South Sudan had too many other pressing issues.
It is just a question of priorities. And so, as you know, South Sudan was fighting within itself. And after the peace agreement, the government was also committed to finance the transitional government of national unity, including ensuring institutional reforms that were provided for under the peace agreement, and equally to fund the implementation of the agreement in its entirety, including security sector governance.
Each member state in the East African community contributes $7.2 million annually to the regional bloc. President Salva Kiir is set to take up the chairmanship of the East African community later this month. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, Michael J. Adler, has on several occasions called on the transitional government of national unity to start providing services to South Sudanese using the country's oil revenue. Ambassador Adler announced this week that the Biden administration is set to cut funding for humanitarian operations in South Sudan due to the growing number of emergencies around the world. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we bring you the latest in the Hamas-Israeli conflict. That story is coming up right after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today he welcomes Israel's agreeing to daily humanitarian pauses in its offensive in northern Gaza, but also said, quote, "too far many Palestinians have died and suffered in the month-long conflict." Fighting has raged in northern Gaza since Hamas gunmen poured over the border into Israel on October 7 and, according to Israeli officials, killed 1,400 people and seized about 240 hostages. Israel has retaliated with an aerial bombing and ground offensive that the health ministry in the Hamas-run Gaza Strip say has killed more than 11,000 people, many of whom are children. Our reporter in Jerusalem, Linda Gradstein, briefed my colleague Yahya Swihib on the latest.
Well, first of all, there's heavy fighting in Gaza. The Israeli troops have reached the perimeter of the Shifa hospital, and Palestinians say that there was tank fire. The Israeli army is not confirming it, and there are hundreds of people who are sheltering in the Shifa hospital or patients who can't be moved. Israel has warned Palestinians to evacuate all of the hospitals in northern Gaza and says that Hamas is using the underneath underneath the hospital and has built a bunker and a command center. There are also some more tensions up north where after an apparent missile strike by Hezbollah or that came from Syria, Israel struck Syria and Hezbollah says seven of its members were killed. So it seems that both the fighting is intensifying in Gaza in the south and tensions between Israel and Hezbollah in the north.
The Hamas government actually today said that Israeli airstrike on the territory's largest hospital killed 13 people. But the Israeli army, like you mentioned, has repeatedly accused Hamas of using hospitals, particularly Al-Shifa, you know, to coordinate their attacks against the army.
That's right. And Israel has, Israel has repeatedly said that everybody should leave. And in the last few days, thousands of Palestinians who were still in northern Gaza, despite Israeli warnings to leave, have fled to the south. Israel says Hamas is using people and patients in the hospitals as human shields. Palestinians deny the fact, the Israeli accusation that Hamas has a bunker underneath the hospital. They say that Israel's just making this up and is just using it as a way to target civilians.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken actually said today he welcomed Israel agreeing to daily humanitarian pauses in its offensive in northern Gaza.
Yes. I mean, Israel has, you know, continued to say that it does not want to hit the civilians in Gaza, that its target is Hamas and the Hamas leadership, and that they have killed dozens of high-ranking Hamas people, that they have hit 130 tunnels and have hit some 15,000 Hamas targets in terms of infrastructure and things like that in Gaza. That said, Gaza is a very densely populated area, and according to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the death toll is something like 10,800, including thousands of children. So, you know, I think the United States is growing increasingly concerned about the humanitarian situation and the growing death toll of civilians, and hopes that these humanitarian pauses are sort of the first step towards a ceasefire. Now, Israel says there cannot be a ceasefire until all of its 240 hostages are released. There are talks going on and have been going on with Egypt and Qatar to try to do some sort of limited hostage release in exchange for a temporary ceasefire. I just saw, by the way, that according to the health ministry, and again, it's affiliated with Hamas, the death toll has crossed 11,000 since the war began on October 7th. They're saying, according to the health ministry, it includes 4,500 children, and more than 27,000 people have been wounded.
And lastly, Linda, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at first kind of said, you know, controlling Hamas, you know, the security. But now basically he's saying we do not seek to govern Gaza. We do not seek to occupy, but we seek to give it, you know, a better future.
Yes, except that Israel never really intended to reoccupy Gaza. It doesn't want to have to provide municipal services to a very poor population of 2.2 million people, more than a million of whom are Palestinian refugees. Netanyahu has also said that Israel will have to maintain security control of Gaza, at least for a while. What seems to be shaping up is some sort of international consortium which would help the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank, to run Gaza. The Palestinian Authority says it will only do so in the context of the two-state solution, meaning an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which really does not seem very likely, at least in the short term.
That was journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem speaking with my colleague Yehes Wihub. It's time to hear what you think about the issues in this broadcast, and we start with Rod Rangball from Longocheck in Upper Nile County. He writes, "These continuous chronic food shortages in our country require our leaders to rethink about it. Let the oil money go to agricultural sector to boost our food production and not to use for killing ourselves." Jacob Dior Macheng from Rumbek writes, The Juba Bahar al-Ghazal highway construction is under attack from the rainwater. This is happening due to substandard work being done by ARC company. The local engineers need to be involved if the government wants quality work. Martin Mayuel Wigulf in Juba writes, "Hello. Allow me to extend my heartfelt condolences and tribute to fallen hero of faith, late Bishop Paddy de Taban, a veteran religious leader who have no replacement in our hearts as Christian families. The late retired Bishop Taban was a spiritual symbol of unity for South Sudanese believers. May his soul rest in perfect peace." Simon Seme in Yei writes, "Hey John Tanza, as we mourn our late Bishop Paddy de Taban in South Sudan, I'm requesting the leadership of the country to build a peace memorial center in the name of Bishop Paddy de Taban in order for all South Sudanese to remember his great contributions in the Republic of South Sudan." Another listener says he's filled with anticipation and happiness as we approach the upcoming elections. He says the prospect for peaceful transitioning of the country from democracy fills him with hope and optimism. He says, "Together, let us embrace the opportunity to shape the future of the nation through a democratic process that reflects the will of the people. With unity and a commitment to peaceful change, we can pave the way for a brighter future and more inclusive future for all." That's Mading Malwal Aluang in Juba talking. Sabri Kamis Isaac in Yambia writes, "As Israel is determined to eliminate the presence of Hamas in Gaza, let them respect some of the international laws of engagement, because not all Palestinians are terrorists." Another listener writes, "Hello, John. I'm writing from Yei, small London, as our politician normally calls it. Our roads are seriously in bad condition, and some of the problems cannot be resolved unless our leaders are serious and they can bring development to the people. Views in this segment does not represent the views of Voice of America or South Sudan in Focus. Keep your comments brief, and we shall sample them every Friday. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. That's all we prepared for you this Friday. We now leave you in a dancing mood with Tony Nyadondo. Listening to Tony Nyadondo from Kenya with that song in his native Jaluo language. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Chang, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.